Good evening. And apologize for the screen and some printer malfunction this evening. So, the Buddha's truth, what he is said to have woken up to. Sort of at his awakening, the beginning of what we call Buddhism and the path we try to follow, places human suffering at its very center. Dukkha, which is the Pali term that we usually translate as suffering, addresses the human experience of unease or unsatisfactoriness is maybe a more appropriate translation, or emotional or mental anguish. And so the Buddhist promise is that by understanding our own and others' feelings of unease, unsatisfactoriness, understanding its causes, and by understanding and following a path of avoiding the usual pitfalls our karmic consciousness like to lead us into. We can begin to turn this dis-ease into opportunities for growth by following the path that's been recommended to us. So at the root of this disease are three primary factors from which all other frustrations and sources of distress follow, usually greed, anger, and delusion or ignorance. These are, if you see a depiction of the 12-fold chain of dependent co-arising, they're at the center of it, driving this wheel. Our karma leading us to repeat the same mistakes as we are prone to. And so tonight I want to talk about with some forms of frustration and anger, and especially when it risks falling into a desire for a perceived wrong to be righted. The last couple of months I've spoken about the Bodhisattva vows and precepts in general, and I was intending to move on from this topic after the precept ceremony last month. But just with trying to speak about what feels alive for me and what sort of has inspired me in my dharmic reflections, I feel called to address this tonight. This has come in part through, I've been listening to Jonathan Ng, I think is his name's autobiography of Dr. King, and just how his teachings on around addressing anger and sort of speaking to the injustice and the anger that's present in his time, while sort of abstaining from finding a middle path of not letting that anger fall into destructiveness, and how to care for that emotion without suppressing it. And also fascinated by a couple of episodes of Hidden Brain listened to, and in the Maha Ratnakuta Sutra, which is a collection of Mahayana, early Mahayana sutras. Upali, which is one of the male monastics who show up repeatedly, he asks the Buddha to compare breaking the precepts out of desire, or greed, anger, hatred, or delusion, ignorance. So his question is, which one of these three offenses as the most serious. And the Buddha answers to him and says that if a bodhisattva continues to break precepts out of desire for kalpas as numerous as the sands of the Ganges, their offense is still minor. If a bodhisattva breaks precepts out of hatred, even just once, this offense is very serious. Why? Because a bodhisattva who breaks precepts out of desire still holds sentient beings in their embrace, whereas a bodhisattva who breaks precepts out of hatred forsakes sentient beings altogether. This is not to minimize transgressions such as those carried out of sexual greed, which can be very severe, especially when they involve significant power differentials. This is a teaching that was given to a monastic who functioned within a context where sexual misconduct would have him expelled from a monastic sangha. So the Buddha continues to explain this to a Pali and says that if a bodhisattva is not thoroughly conversant in the precepts, they will be afraid when they transgress out of desire, but not be afraid when the transgression is out of hatred. But if they're well versed in the precepts, they will be less afraid when transgressing out of desire and very afraid when transgressing out of hatred. The point he appears to be making is that most practitioners will be more mindful of how desire operates within one's own mind and apply some judgment to it, and not it doesn't involve turning away from the world, from other beings. But when anger and hatred overcomes us, this is can be much more dangerous. If we don't study it closely. Shantideva, in his Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life, one of the most famous and quoted chapters is chapter 6 on patience. And he speaks by patience as the antidote for anger. And so the first three verses makes this point very clear. It says, all the good works gathered in 1,000 ages, such as deeds of generosity and offerings to the blissful ones, a single flash of anger can shatter them. No evil is there similar to anger, no austerity to be compared with patience. Steep yourself, therefore, in patience, in various ways, insistently. Those tormented by the pain of anger never know tranquility of mind. Strangers they will be to every pleasure. They will neither sleep nor feel secure. Some pretty stark words. Tenshin Reb Anderson, senior Dharma teacher at San Francisco Zen Center, in his commentary on the precepts and being upright, as he talks about the precept of not harboring ill will, sort of aligns his teachings with the sutra above and quotes it, and speaks of how he has seen Zen students a lot less concerned about anger and desire, and saying, I've seen Zen students shout at each other violently with little or no remorse, not understanding either their impact on others' well-being, nor this lack of concern about their deportment, how it jeopardizes their own spiritual practice. So this all raises the question of, then should we never be angry? Is anger always bad, harmful? And if you read Shantideva, it almost sounds like this in some ways. Reb doesn't go as far. He distinguishes between the practice of arhats, those who practice solely for their own awakening, and bodhisattvas, who seek the awakening of all. He says that for the practice of arhats, it's, their meditation practice is to transcend anger and desire, but it can lack in compassion. Whereas for bodhisattvas, who practice for all, a middle path of to, he summarizes, is to not be angry when anger is inappropriate, and to be angry when anger is appropriate. Anger is definitely part of human life. The question is how to live within it in a way that is beneficial rather than harmful. That's the challenge. And he adds that if you become inappropriately angry, then you are committed to not holding such anger in your heart. This is to not harbor ill will. And then, so how do we distinguish between what's appropriate and inappropriate anger? Becomes a question then. So it relies really on already having a strong commitment to refrain from evil and practicing all good, and to cultivate compassion for others too, by being grounded in the three pure precepts. One would be better able to distinguish between appropriate and inappropriate anger. Appropriate, you know, roughly like in the face of injustice, and inappropriate when overcome, and it becomes, it's like sort of selfish and personal in a way. But, as I was listening to these couple of Hidden Brain episodes on revenge and holding grudges, some of these neuroscientists speak about how studies they've done and how sort of when you're seeking or desiring, even just imagining some form of revenge, which is really, you know, wanting somebody, feeling this, been wronged in some way, and wanting somebody else to suffer, that feels like justice. This scientist, psychologist that we're talking to, fascinating. He said he was so close to revenge and really harming somebody, and stopped himself with enough clarity to see that he did not want to pay the consequences of going to prison, possibly a long time. Became a lawyer because because he found that this was a way, actually, to, and he claims that a big part of the court system functions like it's a legitimate way for people to seek revenge. Through legal means, so you minimize the cost to yourself. It's a kind of a stark way of looking at law, but some of it, and his, you know, seems to function that way. Anyway, but he points out that these neuroscientists are studying, like, what's sort of the driving force for seeking revenge? Like, it's got to give you some pleasure somewhere for it to be, you know, sort of folk wanting, you know, motivation to seek it or to imagine it, right? And as it is a pleasure that's short-lived, and similarly to, it has kind of an addictive quality, functions similarly to addiction. sort of the retaliation or the imagination of it offers, you know, this kind of short-lived stimulation that can be experienced as positive, but it's not healthy for us. And in fact, it's just sort of addictive, but it changes all, also it conditions us like an addiction will. Each time we're overcome by anger and it falls into a desire for somebody else to suffer in some ways, it's or even just overcome by anger, you know, and overtaken by the emotion, then the previous times when we felt that way will be sort of much more closely, you know, we can recollect them much more easily as well. And so it starts to sort of shape how we look upon the world. One of the scientists talks about having been really disappointed in a friend and a really good friend who kind of leaves and just falls into a funk about this. And then from that place, it's so much easier to feel that, you know, the world isn't meeting him and isn't, you know, he's being abandoned and taken for granted and so forth and kind of snaps out of it, but just, his wife sends him to Safeway when he wants to go shopping somewhere else, and then he doesn't really want to go there. And then when the item he's supposed to go for, it's sold out, and he's just like, oh, you know, this world, you know, the world is doing this to me. And it's like, just once you're sort of believed, the more we believe our own story about how we've been wronged, the easier it is to fall into believing that, you know, this is, you know, the less it takes to fall into that story again, right? So that's something we want to watch out for. And it seems like that's even kind of, even when there seems to be a, we're, you know, we're really kind of justified in feeling angry, there's, that is still the case. Dr. Martin Luther King, is in his writings about racism the black people experience and still experience to this day in this country very much and elsewhere, he just warned around the anger within the movement, civil rights, for the anger to turn into bitterness, that saying that some people deal with this problem, as you well know, by getting caught up in the response of bitterness. They feel that the best way, they feel that's the best way. They end up dealing with their frustration by taking out their anger with the universe, their anger with life, on other people and other things. In short, they become mean. And that a key component, according to him, in the emotion of anger and the response that follows is that having been aroused by injury, by the inflicting of some pain, or the perception of infliction of pain, anger easily seeks to this sort of desire to retaliate, and for him it was really important that anger shouldn't be suppressed, but also it shouldn't merely be treated as a fuel towards change. That's not going deep enough. If anger is merely treated as like this is as a means towards some other end, it's not going deep enough. We really need to actually transform our anger in some ways. Quote, anger at injustice to be channeled into a revolution of love and creativity. So this is, I think, our bodhisattva way as well. Sounds not so easy. But sorry, I'm wanting to bring this from systemic issues and large-scale affairs that we can be angry about, because there's plenty of them. I also want to bring it back to the personal, because I think this is really where we need to begin this sort of transformation, and to include it in some ways. I had I started a new job yesterday. I've been sitting through a day and a half of orientations, and so the night before Sunday night, I didn't sleep well. It made me irritated and annoyed, and it was quite easy in that state to turn some of that towards my beloved wife, and the feeling like this is so easy for the mind. Lack of sleep will make it easier to get angry or upset, to start the creation of some story of how, like, she was a cause of you know, of why I didn't sleep well, and so forth. And I had the opportunity of as I to study this and to try to be with my anger, because what I saw in it was this, it's just this impulse of wanting to deliver, to sort of to let her know how you did this to me, sort of to sort of for this to land for on this person that I love and live with and share a life with, but even like to see like there, that's just like, it just seemed like that's a little edge that, you know, is kind of actually ill will, you know, it's wanting this person to feel something. And if I'm capable of this with my own wife, like how much more with other beings in this world, right? And so and taking care of it and kind of owning my own emotion and staying clear of the blame, I think it's another, a more common tendency for me is to be like, oh, it's fine, you know, to like, to brush away my emotions. That's much more what I'm prone to. In the end, I think I found a way of expressing myself that honored my emotion but didn't point a finger and blame. You know, there was something that I think contributed to, you know, my lack of sleep, but not with any blame. And I don't know that my delivery was perfect, but it was heard and received, and it did not cost offensiveness. And it was actually a really sweet moment. Then I went and sat through these orientations, and they were fine, actually. turned out I wasn't that tired after all. And so I think, we each got to find our way to honor that emotion and see how it's, the unique ways in which it will tend to overtake us at times, and what is it that we want to do with it, and is it driving us in any kind of way to, you know, even express our emotion in a way that's the even just has a little taint of wanting to hurt, you know. It's okay to express how we feel, but with what's our intention? Is it to come closer together and understand each other better, or is it to, you know, is there some ill some conceit in there. Anyway, those are my thoughts for tonight. Thank you very much.